All right, are we ready to roll? We've got a good group in here, which is great, because when I walked in, this room was freezing. So we'll warm it up fast enough, I'm sure. This breakout session is, as you all know, about a rhetorical concept that we've come to refer to as the pig fest. And I'm going to explain a little bit more about why we think that this concept is an idea whose time has come. But I want to ask before we get started, if any of you can give any rationale for coming up with a term for a rhetorical roundtable like pig fest. Why would we select the pig as a mascot for a rhetorical roundtable discussion? Any ideas? Very tasty. Okay, so you're all thinking in terms of like pig picking, huh?
A gluttonous event.
It's a gluttonous event. That's getting closer. It's getting warmer.
Intellectually as well as.
Yes. The pig is a symbol of what? I'm sorry, what? Yeah, indulgence. The other white meat. The pig is a symbol of indulgence. And one of the reasons why this name came to be, a pig festing, is that we wanted to gather together to indulge in good food and good conversation about the big ideas of the day. But there are some other aspects of the pig, by the way, that we've had a lot of fun with throughout the years. And you could come up with any mascot that you think would be appropriate for your own rhetorical roundtable discussions. This is just meant to agitate ideas. But we selected the pig because the pig is also known for its ability to forage for hidden treasure. A lot of people don't know, but the pig is generally considered to be the most intelligent animal in the barnyard. And as one of my friends who happens to have a farm pointed out, they also breed very well. I don't know what that has to do with this discussion. But anyway, that's kind of the background of how we came up with this concept of the pig fest as a name for the discussion that we're going to be facilitating, or these roundtable discussions that we do facilitate. I mentioned yesterday in the brief comments that I shared with a large group that it seems to me that our nation is suffering from an epidemic deficit of dialogue. You reach your own conclusions about that, but there used to be all kinds of mechanisms for engaging us as a people in significant dialogue in the course of our everyday lives. Porches, for example, here in the South, were a place where people met and gathered and conversed. And not only did we have porches, but even more basically, we had meal tables that tended to be attended in a way that they're not today, that were part of family life. And we have lost many of those things. Though there are signs of this continuing appetite for meaningful dialogue, like the resurgence of the coffee house and even some social networking is a reflection of this desire for connectedness and for dialogue. But we have indeed as a people, as a culture, experienced the demise of dialogue about things that matter. And to turn that tide, beginning with ourselves, beginning with our families, beginning with our schools, our churches, etc., we have to commit to being intentional. It just isn't going to happen that we're going to engage in systemic dialogue about things that matter if we aren't intentional about pursuing it. And that's really what this discussion is about. We talked briefly yesterday in those comments that I made about the state of our family. You've all heard statistics about how much dialogue a parent has with the child in the course of a day. It's pathetic. You can look at all different studies, but it usually boils down to minutes of meaningful dialogue in the course of a day. The erosion of meal times is an enormous challenge for us right now as families, the minimization of intergenerational contact. What a horrendous loss we're experiencing as a culture as a consequence. And preoccupation with new forms of media that tends to put us in silos instead of, again, in connected environments. In our churches, we're having similar challenges in that we used to frame moral and spiritual formation around an ordered dialogue about the first principles of the faith. And unfortunately, if we talk about at least the evangelical community, in many respects, we threw out the baby with the bathwater and pushed the whole notion of catechetical tradition out of our churches. And we're seeing the effect of this in part through the attrition of high school kids who, as soon as they are leaving homes of faith, are leaving the faith in stunning percentages. These are all bellwether concerns that we should be taking note of. There's a lack of civility in our public discourse as well. Ad hominem attacks, in other words, attacks on the person rather than on ideas, have left us in a place where we've had modeled this kind of dialogue that so quickly devolves into a labeling and attack mode that very few of us have ongoing, significant, strategic interaction with people who really have very different opinions than our own. We tend to cloister around those whom we're comfortable with, and as a consequence, we don't grow as much, and we certainly can't reach out and help others to grow in directions that would be beneficial for them. And so it's created a certain kind of environment and that has made it very difficult for meaningful dialogue to happen. I jokingly referred yesterday to the soundbite commercialism that results in political campaigns organized around a single word like change, right? We hear it every election cycle. Makes me chuckle. And we don't tend to be really intuitive about pressing through that kind of hyperbole into questions like change from what to what and why. Edmund Burke, as a counter to all of that, reminded us that it's really private voluntary groups of people, not what happens at the stage level, the little platoons, as he called them, that shape the conscience of the nation. And historically, those little platoons were organized around intentional conversation about ideas that matter. And each one of us has opportunities to be part of the reorganization of those little platoons, including those little platoon discussions in our schools. I don't know about you, but if we look at the schooling environment as a whole in America, I think we'd all agree that there are many very troubling trends and statistics. But if you peel back beneath the trends and statistics, one of the things that's most concerning to me as a parent in terms of what I'm seeing in the up-and-coming generation of youth is this problem of apathy, I don't know and I don't care, right, and disengagement. And we're not going to address that in a significant way until, as educators, we bridge this divide, this us-them teacher-student divide in some significant and meaningful ways, ultimately the significant and meaningful ways being about getting them engaged in the dialogue of the great conversation relating to matters of life rather than having them simply looking at it as an observer, as a student. And that's part of what this is all about, because in the classical education model, we've organized the whole process around a structure, the structure of the trivium, the structure that moves from this grammar stage where we're assembling in the learner the basic building blocks of knowledge, right, to the second phase where we're moving into dialectic, the understanding of how those building blocks of knowledge are assembled into structures, buildings, if you will, arguments, however you want to describe them, and then moving into this third stage of rhetoric where those things that have now been assembled, those grammatical building blocks assembled, are communicated and presented to the world. It's a simplistic way of summarizing the trivium, but the point is that that last stage, that rhetorical stage, is so critical because as the capstone of the trivium, it does much more than establish the skills of communication. We tend to view rhetoric as being about the development of communication skills. It's about a lot more than that, because in that rhetorical stage, that final stage of the classical education, you have synapses occurring where in the process of communicating, you are making ideas your own. And in making ideas your own, there are connections that happen that take the whole learning process and move it on. And that is what is not happening in the case of too many students today. My dad likes to say, he had so many little pithy things that he gave us kids, and so many of them at the time I thought were ridiculous, but as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate every one of them more and more. But one of the statements that he used to make to us very often is, nothing's dynamic until it's specific. In other words, you know, get into it, and then you'll start seeing how it comes to life. My very first Pigfest, I remember somebody making a comment about history, and this was when I was in high school. And I made the snide remark, which is a reflection of where I was at the time, that history is dull, boring, and irrelevant. And the moderator said, you know, Jimmy, if you learn to live the history that you're reading, you will learn to love the history that you're reading. And the point that he was making is nothing is dynamic until it's specific. Get in, and then it'll come to life. And this is very much the case as it relates to the importance of rhetoric. We're trying to build a bridge that takes learners from that place where they look at the great conversation to an active engagement in the great conversation. Unfortunately, what happens too often in the educational process that our kids are experiencing today is that they don't get in the conversation until they're in a hostile environment. And those synapses haven't been made, and then we're surprised. C.S. Lewis, in his remarkable book about moral and spiritual formation, The Abolition of Man, has that classic synthesis where he says, you know, we laugh at honor, but are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate the gildings, and we bid them be fruitful, right? Well, to a certain extent, that's what we're doing with our students. When we don't engage them in a great conversation in a place where they're in a structured environment, the table is tilted toward truth, and they can make those synapses happen before they're in hostile territory. And that's what this initiative of developing rhetorical roundtables is all about. Just to be clear, the Pigfest is one example of a rhetorical roundtable format that I've been part of and have helped facilitate for others. That's just the name. The concept is what's critical here. There's nothing being sold. There's no attachment to the brand. So understand as we go forward that I'm going to be using that as a placeholder for whatever brand you may think is appropriate for capturing this concept of rhetorical roundtable. The most influential contemporary writer on this subject, in my view, is a gentleman named Mortimer Adler. Some of you may recognize his name. He has contributed so much to the world of classical thought. He's just a remarkable thinker. He was a professor at the University of Chicago, among other things, assembled a great book series, has written a whole host of very practical books introducing people to classical thought, like the 10 Key Philosophical Mistakes and other books. But this area was one of his real passion points. And I'm doing my doctoral research right now on reclaiming a vibrant catechism and why the notion of ordered dialogue is so important. And Adler has been a key reference point. And what he says is that we have to be intentional about this engagement and then be very strategic and tactical in understanding optimal dynamics while pursuing these kinds of conversations. Adler even got to the point where he would create different configurations for these roundtable discussions, putting students in the round, putting students in a square seating arrangement, putting people at the table, just in chairs, etc., and studying and observing different results. If any of you are interested in that kind of data, I can give you more reference materials, but the point is, it is intentional that you get around a table and that you're facing one another, that it's not the us-them kind of structure that we have going on here, but that it's conversational. We're going to talk about more of those dynamics as we go through the presentation, but the focus on what's true, why it matters, and how you defend it is what's vital to get at. Communicating arguments in a supportive, structured environment of challenging peer and non-peer thinkers. My wife and I have hosted Pigfest gatherings at our home for many years. And we have participants in each one of our Pigfests, just imagine this, ranging in age from 17 to 70 in a typical month's gathering. Where do you get that these days? Where do you get into a discussion with people of that age range, Christians and non-Christians, in an organized way talking about the great issues of the day? It's just not happening. Your schools are a perfect environment to bring this old idea back forward again. And we'll talk more as we go here in terms of how you can do it. When I say this old idea, I mean old because it indeed is a very integral and well-tested element of the classical education model. In fact, you go back to Socrates himself, who influences every one of our rhetorical roundtable gatherings through his questioning methodology, you'd see the benefit of approaching dialogue by giving students the tool to ask those three basic questions. Chuck Colton actually adds a fourth, which I really like, but how do you define your terms? How do you know what you're saying you know? And what does it matter? So what? Colson likes to add a fourth, which is, and what if you're wrong and you die? But it's great to have these kinds of conversations instilled in the way that a person thinks about key issues so that they have some kind of systemic structure. I had the privilege of studying at Oxford, and one of the things that stunned me about the classical education experience at Oxford is that it wasn't centered in the classroom. It wasn't centered in the classroom. The educational experience at Oxford was not centered in the classroom. In fact, have any of you studied over there? Oxford or Cambridge or in any of those classical education institutions? The stunning thing is classes are optional. The small group interaction with your tutor is not. And meal hall attendance is not. In fact, what they would tell you is that the capstone of an Oxford education happens in the, can anybody guess? What? In the meal hall. It's in the meal halls. That's why if you go, you know, I was at St. Peter's College, but you go to any of the great colleges that form the universities there, at the center of each one of those colleges is what? An amazing meal hall. I ate actually under the portraits of Newton and the jurist Blackstone. It was incredible because they just created an environment where people would gather on a structured basis and talk about the important issues of the day. And the tables were populated with people from all over the world. So professors ate with us. My very first discussion at a meal hall in Oxford was with students from four different continents, and the first subject that came up is, how can somebody say that homosexuality is not natural? That was the first discussion. So it was baptism by fire for this little North Carolina boy. But obviously the principles that we're talking about here were not principles specific to Socrates, not principles specific to the classical model per se. We certainly find them highlighted as well in the biblical tradition. One gospel account alone, for example, Jesus asks 54 questions. 54 questions. You know, that is just stunning to me, because what it does is it highlights the fact that you have the Son of the Living God giving us an example of how to interact with other people, and one of the ways that he clearly underscores the way to do it is by asking questions. The one, capital O, who didn't need to ask questions was asking questions. It's an incredible signal to us in terms of how to get on. Jesus was continually interacting with mixed company. Very unlike too much of our schools and too much of our churches do today. We need to be more engaged with the notion of ambassadorship than we are. And don't misunderstand me here. There are many people who, with regard to kids in a lot of your schools, would say, hey, listen, they should be out there where they're experiencing the world, right? They're ships. They should be set out to sea. But the reality is that we're not born ships. Children are not born ships. And the reality is that many people are perhaps unintentionally sending boats, dinghies, damaged ships out into deep water when they're certainly not ready. And Jesus demonstrated a passion for pursuing truth through conversation, and specifically through conversational mealing with other people, including people that represented this mixed company, where in the gospel accounts we again find him asking questions. Very interesting. So don't let somebody say to you that this concept is a purely Greek concept, not a biblical concept, therefore are we sure that it has much value. It's both. All truth is God's truth, and so the fact that we see good things highlighted in the classical model doesn't mean that it's a classical model versus a biblical model. Don't create that false dichotomy. Here's what we read in 1 Peter 3:15. With regard to these kinds of principles that are highlighted in the way that Jesus approached dialogue. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts regard the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Ultimately, a lot of this is about helping to create those synapses that are part of the formation of a worldview. Some of the key worldview questions from a Christian point of view would be, where did I come from? Creation. What's wrong with the world? The fall. Is there anything that can be done to fix it? Redemption. And how then, based on 1 through 3, should I then live? Actually, this is not an approach to worldview from a Christian point of view. This is an approach that any worldview it can be processed through. and therefore it helps as you're going through these rhetorical roundtables to have these kinds of grids that are constantly in play, being structured by the students that are engaged in the dialogue. We like to say that this is an idea whose time has come again. The notion of kneeling together around the table to discuss the great issues of the day. When we say that, in part we're referencing a whole host of examples that inspire the idea. This is an historic idea. It is a time-tested idea. And I want to give you just a couple examples. Many of you saw recently the film Amazing Grace, which was about the British parliamentarian William Wilberforce, who was so involved, among other things, in the abolition of the slave trade. Wilberforce met regularly, most often weekly, for years and years and years, with his trusted circle, referred to as the Clapham Circle. Newton, who came out of that same story, give an example from the same age, did the same thing, met at the Falcon in the pub. Lewis and his friends, Tolkien, Dorothy Sayers, and others met at, they called themselves the Inklings, and they met at, anybody know? Yeah. The Bird and the Baby, which was their way of referring to the eagle and the child. If any of you get to go over to England, stop in and see these places. They're amazing. But they would get, I chuckle, by the way, every time I go there, thinking about that moment when C.S. Lewis had just read the last chapter of his draft of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Tuck and said, "Jack, I just don't think it's going to work." But these were amazing groups that met not for a year, they met for years and years and years, many of them for decades, which is the reason why I highlight them. Ben Franklin, in fact, and his Junto Society met for 40 years on Friday nights. In the next section, I'm going to explain a little bit more of the detail of how we approach these rhetorical roundtables, because a lot of them are pulled out of the research that I did on Franklin in particular and the way that he organized his group gatherings. But imagine this, okay? In Ben Franklin's group, 12 guys, totally eclectic, printers, legislators, you had a cobbler, and so forth, 12 guys meeting 40 years, accomplishing the following as a result of their commitment to those gatherings. The idea of paved roads came from that group. The nation's first fire department came from that group. The nation's first public library was the Junto Library. The Junto later became the American Philosophical Society. Those guys banded together and they started an institution now called the University of Pennsylvania. and on it goes. It is amazing. If you get a chance, read Ben Franklin's autobiography and you'll see the things that came out of that group, which highlights another very important point relating to rhetorical roundtables that work, especially as we're trying to engage kids in today's day and age. It's important to have a focus of application. It's not just about ideas, the esoteric discussion that tends to go over the top of a lot of kids' heads in particular, but even over the tops of many of our own heads. It's about ideas that are important in part because those ideas become incarnational. And they become incarnational, going back to that statement, nothing's dynamic until it's specific, as those ideas are brought to life in ways that may be small but are significant to those who are taking ownership of them. When I started this experience, I was, as I mentioned yesterday, a sophomore in high school. And I had been a straight-A student all the way through my eighth grade year, and then we went through the third move in a two-year period as a family, and I just kind of fell off the map and disengaged for a whole variety of reasons. I was in conflict with my father, and I just disengaged and became very apathetic and fell into that that massive rank of students that were and are committed to the mediocre. And one of the reasons why I'm here with you today, when I really don't have time to be here today, candidly, given everything that's going on. We're in the middle of a foreign adoption, our 11th child right now, a little Down syndrome boy from Ecuador, and couldn't be a crazier time at the office and everything else. But I'm here because I was given a gift. I was given a gift. A coin was put in my hand by the master. In that sophomore year, I was invited to go to an event called the Pig Fest. And as I mentioned yesterday, admittedly, I went for the food. But when I showed up and I saw all of these different people, and again, it wasn't an age-segregated discussion. There were different ages of people involved. For me, it was an absolutely new and radical experience because I'd been a third-party observer of the Great Conversation. I wasn't connected with eclectic people in dialogue. And when I got involved in this discussion and then began going to these groups, a fire was lit. I realized, to use that old maxim, that my bucket was getting packed full, my pail was being packed with data, facts, and so forth, but the fire hadn't been lit. And it lit the fire, and it changed. It changed who I was as a person. It marked the beginning of my classical education experience. Even though in some ways I was classically educated, at the time I was at an all-boy Jesuit high school. It was considered to be the top private high school in Milwaukee, Marquette University High School. And yet I wasn't engaged until that moment. It also marked the beginnings of a new journey for me as a believer, as a follower of Christ, in that I saw this passion for learning drawing me to truth and calling me to be intentional about living out that truth. So, in terms of the origin of the Pig Fest idea, and this notion that this is an idea whose time has come, the Pig Fest Society was organized years ago when my wife and I said, this is a unique opportunity to steward an important idea forward. And we began this regular gathering of eclectic people around a hosted table. Those are all key concepts in terms of what a pig fest, in terms of one rhetorical roundtable expression, includes. If we miss any of these pieces, we miss something. There's a little tingle that you feel when the moderator makes the introduction, and I almost always begin this way, by connecting our little gathering to other historic gatherings that have happened through the ages. And usually read a clip from one of those gatherings, and it just connects you with this flow that's moving through history of these little platoons that gather to help shape and move forward the good things, the beautiful things, and the true things in the culture. And so that's how we begin, with this connectedness to the historic idea. We make the gatherings regular. If you don't gather regularly, even though Mark shared about the experience at Caldwell, a one-time experience, very positive thing, there's no question that that can be a positive thing on a one-time basis, but where the magic really begins to happen is as you develop some regularity, because then, among other things, some of the inhibitions fade and the engagement model advances. People understand how to form a good proposition and what is not a good proposition, and so forth. So making it a regular gathering is important. When I say an eclectic group of people, what I mean is this, that we tend to fly with birds of a feather, and if God made the world so that everybody was identical, it wouldn't be a very exciting world, would it? Well, conversations with people in this kind of format who think identical are not particularly exciting. Engage people's diversity of thought and perspective and experiences as you are facilitating these roundtable discussions. That's where the magic happens. In the next session, as we talk about some of Ben Franklin's rules, one of them that we borrowed and brought forward is the devil's rule, which means that anybody at any given time in the rhetorical roundtable discussion can assume a devil's advocate position without announcing it. He said that that was vitally important for a couple of reasons. Number one, to have diversity of perspectives and understanding on any given topic. But number two, to help people move away from the lack of civility that characterizes conversation when people disagree. And so what he said is, if somebody can be taken the devil's advocate position at any given time, it helps folks to understand that there may be a twinkle in that person's eye as they're presenting a contrary position or opinion because they're taking the devil's advocate position. Therefore, the focus is on the idea, right? Not on the person. We tend instead to go right to the person. And, you know, God forgive us for the way that we often proceed in subsequent steps, because we're not disciplined to converse that way. And so we have to help change the way that conversation, that dialogue happens. And this is part of the way that we develop those kinds of disciplines. The third point here that you'll notice highlighted in this first paragraph is a hosted table. We have seen, just by studying the historical records of these kinds of conversation groups that really worked, that kneeling together, again, somehow creates a dynamic that is absolutely unique in facilitating conversation. I can't fully explain it. I've seen some attempts to explain it. But the bottom line is that even in, for example, the Caldwell school environment, parents banded together and came in and served the kids in these roundtable formats a meal while these dialogues were happening, and it was really a special part of the experience. Now, you may have to limit that. You may have to modify that. You may have to, in certain cases, even completely abandon that as a concept. But it is a part of the experience that has proven to be very valuable. Further, I think as Christians, it's a great opportunity to connect a couple of things. To connect the teaching and touching ministries of Jesus, of the way that he communicated with people in the gospel, the way that we need to learn to communicate with people in the culture. And so by creating this context of hospitality and by creating an environment of service, of serving others, the table is set for conversation to happen in a way that it too seldom happens today. So, Pigfest are the gathering in schools and homes elsewhere to indulge in great food and great conversation about the important issues of the day, and to sharpen their respective abilities to engage and enhance their communities. I think we've talked about some of these key principles here already, but I want to highlight the last two in particular. Am I supposed to be concluding, by the way, at 9:50? Okay. So even though we started late, we're okay. All right. Let me highlight two really critical points that we make at the onset of almost every rhetorical roundtable gathering. One is that we meet on the platform of truth. Aletheia is the Greek expression for truth, and it literally means an unveiling. And the way that I believe it was Lewis and Tolkien like to refer to it in their gatherings, is that they would picture a statue. They would picture a statue in the center of a circle, in the center of their gathering place, and it was as if the statue was being unveiled, and people were around the room. The truth, the statue, is a fixed object. It's an observable object. In other words, we're not beginning with this discussion that truth is unattainable. We're beginning with the discussion that truth is, and it is attainable. Borrowing from Francis Schaeffer, God is and he has spoken through general revelation, through special revelation, and through personal revelation. But we're beginning with this understanding of truth that it is a thing that can be grasped. However, the statue is helpful as a picture because you have folks looking at the statue from what? From all different points, from different perspectives, from different vantage points. And so it helps us to gain the sense of how we can appreciate the input, the perspective, the experiences, the insights of others. The second really critical concept is that when we go through a rhetorical roundtable experience, historically what we've seen is that it's extremely beneficial to establish what we call rounds. In our case, they're 15-minute rounds. We have a pig alarm clock. It's really funny. And when it goes off, it oinks. And it's this loud oinking noise. And that marks the end of the 15-minute round. Well, it's almost always frustrating because you're certain to have somebody who feels like they haven't fully established their perspective. And what we, as a moderator, like to say is, well, so it is in life. You can't always tie every box up with a nice, neat little bow in the conversations that you have. Again, it's a discipline that we need to learn because we can be so intentional about driving all the way to the conclusion that we think is critical that we lose sight of the opportunity to plant important seeds and let them be. And so conversationally, the notion of moving through these rounds is really helpful, and it keeps things moving. You will inevitably have people who are less interested about one particular subject round and much more interested in the next. If you're fixed on one rambling, rolling discussion, it tends not to work. But I highlight this in this context because we always reserve the last round for what we call the tikkun olam, which is a Hebrew expression for restoring things to rights, using that phrase attributed to Aslan in Narnia. Restoring things to rights, meaning redeeming things to their proper order. That was the Hebrew concept of tikkun olam. And so that last round is reserved for a discussion of how we can take the different points that we've learned or assimilated or been challenged to consider and apply them to an idea like paved roads or public fire departments or whatever else. It has been so exciting to see some of the ideas, even at a student level, that have come out of this section of the discussion, oftentimes facilitated by a particular charge or invitation to have one participant bring forward an initial idea for consideration and contemplation by the group. I'm going to close with this imagining. All right? Imagine this, that classical schools act as a seedbed for these little platoons, to reference that statement from Burke, that will shape the moral conscience of our nation. If the classical school movement is able to engage students who've gone through this kind of training and preparation, these will be students who become influencers rather than students that tend to be the ones who are influenced. Students graduating from your rhetoric schools energized with the defense of their worldview well-tested and seeking application in their world. That ultimately is the focus of this notion of rhetorical roundtables to help ensure that those synapses are happening, that students are becoming learners, and as learners are not simply observing the great conversation, but are getting in the great conversation and helping to lead and drive the discussion. So I want to thank you for being here. In the next session, just so that you know, we're going to dive down into much more of the detail in terms of how these groups are organized and structured. But I really appreciate your attention. Thanks.